Yeah, the History Project really began when the class of 1925 was holding its 50th reunion and decided that it had graduated in the very year that marked the end of the Curdy and Carstensen History of the University, the two-volume history that had been written at the time of the centennial in 1948-49. And Professors Curdy and Carstensen had chosen to end their history in 1925 for a variety of reasons that we don't need to go into here. And the leaders of the class of 1925 kept bugging the then chancellor of the university, Irving Shane, to do something about carrying the story of the university forward. And Chancellor Shane, who was a chemist, approached me because I was the one historian among the deans of the university at the time. I was the dean of the College of Letters and Science, and asked me to try to locate somebody who could begin pulling the records of the university together in suitable form for someone subsequently to use in writing up a volume on the subsequent history of the university. And I located not one but two young recent PhDs, John Jenkins and Barry Tyker, both of whom are sitting here with me, and recruited them for Chancellor Shane's project, thinking that I would thereafter have nothing to do with it. Shane, however, wanted the project to be supervised somewhat, so he said, "You're a historian, you supervise these two young men, and give me a report now and then." So had I ever then realized that I would someday be playing a role in their work, I would have probably given them a little more attention and worked more closely with them. But I didn't get directly involved in the project until I left the deanship in 1989, and then discovered how much work they had actually done. I was very impressed with all they had done in pulling our records together. So their work is really the foundation of the volume that John Jenkins and I have just finished for the University of Wisconsin Press.
John, why don't you talk a little bit about the research that we did in the subsequent years, or the years between when we got appointed and you and Dave started working?
Barry and I started our work in the project in about 1981 and carried on through about 1988 when Barry went over to become the UW oral historian. The reason he left was that his PhD was revoked due to plagiarism. He stole a social studies report from his fifth grade nephew in Portage, Wisconsin. By the way, Barry is also currently under investigation by the UW Faculty Bowling League for fraudulently obtaining a 223 score when his average is only 100 points below that. At any rate, Barry and I, we worked on a number of directions in our studies. We did oral history interviews with people who were associated with the university in the old days, students, faculty, faculty spouses, and anyone else who could lend insights into the history. We also studied or organized data from the university archives and from the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. We looked primarily at things like president's papers, Board of Regents and Board of Visitors papers, deans and directors papers, and faculty papers, and arranged to show references to this material on a computer database that just became possible with the development of the personal computer. Finally, we did a little bit of writing at that time, published a history of the summer session, a history of housing at the university, and developed several working papers on various aspects of university history.
When the two of you subsequently got together, how did you go about dividing up the work and creating an outline for the work?
Well, when I first got involved in setting a work schedule for Barry and John as they started out on the research for the project, we concluded that it would be too much to create in a single volume the story of the university from 1925 down to the time of the merger in after 1971, and that therefore a good break point for Volume 3 would be the end of World War II, probably before the veterans returned in the fall of 1945-46. And that we left that open as to whether we would include the return of the veterans or whether we would have the volume end of the war rather than the return of the veterans. And then that there would be a subsequent volume, Volume 4, that would take the story down to the time of the merger, either just when the merger was being proposed and passed, or the actual implementation of the merger, which took place a couple of years after 1971. And that, of course, is still to be determined. Then we envisioned in the much more distant future a Volume 5 that would carry the story closer to the present. So we, in developing Volume 3, the manuscript for which is now completed, we adhered pretty much to this original format of aiming to tell the story of the university on about the same scale as Curdy and Carstensen's two-volume history, and dealing essentially with a 25-year period from 1925 to 1945 through the end of World War II. That works rather well for a number of reasons, because it happens that there were only two presidents of the university in that period. President Glenn Frank, who served from 1925 to 1937 when he was fired, and Clarence Dykstra, who served as president from 1927 until he left to become the provost at UCLA in early 1945. So we have, in a sense, at the top administration level of the university, just two presidents in this period, a rather long tenure for both of them compared to the average for most of the presidents of the university. There are other reasons, I think, why 1925 marks a good beginning year for the start of our volume. And John, why don't you outline some of those other reasons?
1925 was a pivotal year for the university. It marked the closing of what really was the Van Hise era. President Van Hise had taken office in 1903 and died in 1918. The regents appointed Edward Burge, the first letters and science dean, to be president to take Van Hise's place. And he remained in office until 1925, although expecting right from the start that it would only be a temporary appointment, that he was just a stand-in president, and he didn't expect to take any initiatives as far as moving the university ahead after World War I.
He was 68 at the time he was appointed, so he assumed that his tenure was really just as a stand-in president briefly, but the regents kept him on much longer than he'd expected.
It was a tough time for Burge because the progressive legislature had to deal with hard economic times after World War I with deflation. Also, progressive Governor Blaine was quite suspicious of the university because during the war the faculty had passed a resolution critical of Robert M. La Follette, the U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, who took sort of an anti-war stand. So the public relations of the university had declined during the period, as well as the relationship with the legislature. About 1923, some of the politicians, Robert La Follette, the U.S. Senator, and John Blaine, the governor of Wisconsin, both progressives, started getting interested in finding a replacement for Burge. Eventually, the Board of Regents, working especially with Regent Cronsage, came up with the appointment, or offered the appointment of the presidency to Roscoe Pound, the law dean at Harvard. But Pound eventually turned the job down because he was led to believe, possibly by the writer Zona Gale from Wisconsin, and she was also a regent, that his appointment would be, or at least perceived to be, that of a partisan appointment representing the progressives, and he felt that he shouldn't be a narrow appointee, but instead fit well with the whole state.
What about the Grady resolution in 1920? That was in 25, wasn't it?
Yeah. Let me sort of try to wrap up. Well, after the Pound appointment fell through, the Regents couldn't go ahead and make another try at an appointment because it became evident that the progressives were going to try to cut the university's budget further. And until a dependable and adequate budget was available, they felt that you couldn't get a good president for the university. So President Burge encouraged Regent Cronsage to embark on a public relations campaign that would bring the message to the people of the state and to the legislature and to the governor that the university needed solid economic support, which it had not received during the previous 5 years. The public relations campaign was vigorous, and it worked. And the legislature ended up making a good appropriation for the university, and it heartened the Regents so that they went ahead then and found a president who they felt could bring the university ahead in the public's eye and in the legislature's eye, and that was Glenn Frank, the editor of Century Magazine in New York City. Let me think here. You want to say something about that?
I will when I start talking about the Frank administration.
I guess the point to be made about the time of the Frank hiring was how exciting it was here in Madison and in Wisconsin, that for the first time since the good years of the Van Hise administration, which was well before World War I had begun, people really felt that there was going to be some movement forward with the university and for the state. And Glenn Frank played upon this optimism and encouraged it. And the Board of Regents even responded positively. They were very, very unlikely, or they tended to resist any kind of an activist stance on their own part. And yet, during the summer of 1925, after Glenn Frank was appointed, they took three initiatives that were really, really unusual and impressive. The first was to establish the Wisconsin University Building Corporation, which was a method by which the Regents could go into indebtedness to purchase things for the university, like dormitories or a union building, without directly putting the state into debt, which was proscribed in the Constitution. Another action the Regents
took... I'd say that's a really very creative approach to come up with a device of a captive building corporation that had a revenue stream for its projects that would allow it to pay off the indebtedness as well as handle the operating costs. So the device worked very well for things like dormitories or the Memorial Union, where there was a predictable revenue flow. So the university was able to use the Wisconsin University Building Corporation for the next couple of decades to build some important buildings for the university that the legislature simply was unwilling to fund for one reason or another, or unable during the Depression to fund. So it's a very important model and really became the model for the present State Building Commission.
The second initiative the Regents took during the summer of 1925 was to approve the establishment of the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, which subsequently, during the Depression, perhaps save the university's research base so that it could move ahead after World War II to at least maintain its stature as one of the great research universities of the world. And finally, the Regents passed what became known as the Grady Resolution, which set a policy of refusing to accept funding from incorporated educational foundations, particularly those of Carnegie and Rockefeller. These three actions didn't share any ideological base at all. What they demonstrated was that even the Board of Regents was truly excited about about the prospects for the university under Glenn Frank. Finally, before Frank actually took up his presidency in June of 1925, Michael Olbrich, a regent and a progressive close both to La Follette and to Blaine, gave an address over WHA radio about Frank, and I'd like to read a little bit of that to give something of the flavor of the feeling for Frank's coming to Wisconsin. Olbrich said, "Frank was not imported as the property or protege of an association of owners, but he was invited to be president in his own right, sole proprietor of his job, authorized without condition or reservation to hand out the sign, Glenn Frank, Free President of the Free University of Wisconsin. Wisconsin's golden age is here, with her great young president, with financial provision for the future assured by the legislature and the governor. Who can doubt that our beloved university is on the threshold of her greatest expansion, the greatest renaissance in all her history?"
I think that captures very nicely the spirit with which Frank was received as president of the university in 1925. There were some faculty critics who pointed out that he was very young. He was only 38 when he was appointed, that he had no earned degrees beyond the baccalaureate level, that his previous experience had been as a journalist primarily and not in higher education. His only higher education administrative position previously had been to be the first alumni secretary of Northwestern University, where he had gotten his baccalaureate degree. And there were those who recalled that Frank at one time had been an itinerant preacher. He had been ordained at the age of 12 and had spent one summer touring the Middle West with Billy Sunday as a young man. And at one point, while he was still of high school age, he had held three circuit riding ministries, three different churches in Missouri. So this was a rather different kind of president than the faculty had expected, and I think throughout his administration, the faculty at the university accepted him on the whole with only grudging acceptance. They were unwilling to recognize that he had a really fine mind. He was a generalist who read widely and absorbed everything he read and could recall it. And that essentially he was the kind of outreach president who went over very well with audiences in the state and around the country. He was one of the great orators of his period. And so his appeal was always greater to people outside the university than to the students and the faculty within the university. But for a while, he was extremely popular in the state. He had a strong board of regents that believed in him. And for his first 4 years, until the stock market crash at the end of 1929, Frank had an extended honeymoon. He was riding high, unlike President Burge and Van Hise in his later years. He was able to get the legislature to give the university good budgets, a good building program. And much of the building that came during his presidency was funded in the first 4 years of his administration. So you could say the Frank administration falls into two periods, the honeymoon period until late 1929 or 1930, and after the Depression hit the state and funding became a much more serious problem, Frank fell on hard times along with the university. But in the good period, you could say that Frank's achievements were considerable. He hired Alexander Micklejohn, the president, the former president of Amherst College, because he was attracted to Micklejohn's educational philosophy, and brought Micklejohn here to establish the Experimental College, which remains probably the most famous example of Wisconsin educational innovation. To some extent, Frank really believed that Micklejohn was charged with setting up an experiment that could be monitored against a control group of regular students. And Micklejohn, in that sense, probably disappointed the president, because Micklejohn had a vision of what the new curriculum ought to be that he was to implement, and he was not so interested in experimentation as he was in implementation. He was a missionary, in other words, rather than an educational scientist. So in that sense, Frank, I think, was disappointed that the experimental college didn't turn out quite as he had originally envisioned it. But it lasted for 5 years. It put Wisconsin on the map nationally. And although you could say in many respects it failed, at least for those students who found it an appealing educational venture, and there were a considerable number of them, it was a very heady kind of experimentation that was going on in Adams Hall along the shores of Lake Mendota. Frank also was the first president seriously to try to coordinate student services for the university as a whole, and to develop a more scientific basis of evaluating and improving the articulation of the university with the schools of the state. And he set up the Bureau of Educational Records and Guidance to try to make sure that there would be less waste of young people coming to the university who were not prepared for its educational services. And he improved the orientation program by establishing a varsity welcome program that lasted the better part of a week. He, with his religious background, was interested in the all-university religious convocations and bringing significant national figures to the campus once or twice a year to talk to the students on religious topics. And among his other achievements, he was responsible for the decision to separate the School of Education from the College of Letters and Science and set it up as a more autonomous unit of the university in 1930. Along the way, the school was really set up on an interesting basis as a coordinate school, whereby the decision was made that all Letters and Science students, faculty members who taught education students were automatically members of the faculty of the School of Education, so that you had the School of Education not cut adrift, so to speak, but with continuing ties to its parent college that have remained to some extent right down to the present. And I think that helps to explain why there have always been closer ties between the School of Education faculty and the faculty of the rest of the university at Wisconsin than is true at most universities in the country. Now, with the Depression, Frank fell on hard times, not only because of budgetary reasons, but because of the election of Philip La Follette as governor in the fall of 1930. The La Follettes had never liked Frank. They had a different candidate that they had wanted the regents to select in 1925. And I think both Phil La Follette, the younger son of the senator, and his older brother, young Bob, who had taken his father's seat in the U.S. Senate after his father's death in 1925, saw Frank as potentially a political rival in the state. I mentioned earlier that Frank was a gifted orator. He certainly rivaled Phil La Follette in that regard, and I think both of the La Follette sons concluded that Frank needed to be encouraged to leave the state so he, as a liberal Republican, wouldn't be tempted to develop a political career at their expense. I think there's very little question that Frank was interested in a political career, and that he saw himself, in a sense, as a kind of Republican Woodrow Wilson who might parlay the presidency of the University of Wisconsin into a try for the White House. In any event, La Follette, Governor La Follette, went out of its way to make Frank's life uncomfortable and did little to conceal the fact that he liked him. There were a number of conflicts between the president and the governor in these years. I don't need to go into all of them, but there was increasing criticism of Frank by the progressives, and by 1935, 1936, it was clear that Governor La Follette was hoping that the regents would get rid of President Frank. When La Follette had achieved a working majority of the Board of Regents in 1936 and 37, the decision was made, I think, without any question by the governor, that his regents should take the lead in encouraging Frank to leave. Frank declined to resign, insisted on an open public hearing, and after a very messy two-day public hearing in January of 1937, the board voted by a one-vote margin to fire Frank. If La Follette assumed that this was going to solve his problems, he certainly miscalculated, because the firing of Glenn Frank in January of 1937 brought a storm of protest from around the country. Governor La Follette was compared to Huey Long in his effort to control Louisiana State University. He was talked about in, as if he were a fascist who was trying to ruin the university by taking political control of it. And it's, I think, instructive that never again did Phil La Follette get elected to public office in the state. I think the carryover of the anti-La Follette reaction to the Glenn Frank firing, although it was coupled with other reasons for the public to become disenchanted with Governor La Follette, led to his electoral defeat in 1938, and as I said, never again was he to hold public office in the state, elective public office. And if the La Follette brothers assumed that Frank would leave the state after he was fired, they were badly mistaken. He stayed in the state. He bought a home in Maple Bluff, edited a rural newspaper for a time, and stayed active in national Republican politics, hoping, I think, that he would have a chance at the presidential nomination in 1940. In the end, that didn't work. And Wendell Willkie received the nomination, ironically a distant relative of Regent Willkie, who had led the Frank firing in 1937. After the Republican convention, Frank returned to Wisconsin and in less than 3 weeks managed to do the impossible, to get enough signatures to get onto the ballot, the primary Republican ballot for the fall elections. That means in all 72 counties, he was able to get, without any organization, enough people to sign a petition to get himself on the ballot by petition, and then ran a whirlwind campaign to try to get the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate. The tragedy is we'll never know whether he might have succeeded, because on the Labor Day weekend, just on the Tuesday before the primary election, he was hurrying in a car driven by his son to get to Green Bay for a speaking engagement. The car was speeding and went off the road. He and his son were killed, and of course the election went a different direction. But it's interesting to speculate that if Frank, who was quite popular in the state, had succeeded in getting the Republican nomination, he might very well have gone on to defeat the progressive candidate, young Bob La Follette, and we would have had a rather different political history in the state, because you all know that it was an unknown judge in Appleton, Joseph R. McCarthy, who was able to defeat young Bob La Follette in 1946. So the political history of the state would have been quite different, I think, had Glenn Frank not been killed and had he won the election in 1940. Frank was replaced by a candidate handpicked by the La Follette brothers, Clarence Dykstra, the city manager of Cincinnati, who had come to their attention in his handling of the Great Cincinnati Flood in the spring of 1937. Trying to think, was it 37 or 36? 36. 36. 36, yeah. Anyway, he had come to
Let's do that sentence again, because that's kind of nothing.
All right.
Can you have a drink a little water before you come down?
Oh, okay, drink a little water, I guess you're...
Mm-hmm.
You're sounding dry.
I am. Now, Dykstra had come to the attention of the La Follette brothers by his handling of the Great Cincinnati Flood in 1936. He was known as a consummate manager. He had the very skills as a manager that Glenn Frank had lacked, according to the progressives. He was not the scintillating public speaker that Frank had been. And he clearly had no political ambitions, which was, I think, something of concern to the La Follette brothers. So he seemed a good choice, and he was, I think, somewhat more successful in working with the faculty in administrative matters and in pushing forward the faculty involvement in the administration of the university. Because this period, as John will point out, I think is remarkable for the extent to which the faculty's role in institutional government develops. The Dykstra administration was not as long as the Frank administration, and it was broken, in a sense, by World War II, in which Dykstra played a significant national role as the first director of the Selective Service Administration and in other war manpower issues. So he was away from Madison a good deal of the time and had a less active role as president during the war years. But on the whole, his administration was, I think, quite successful. And it certainly was not marred by the kind of bitter personal partisan rancor that the latter part of the Frank era had. He did have problems with the governor of the period, Julius Heil. Heil had been elected governor in 1938 in reaction to the La Follette era, and was suspicious of Dykstra as the creature of the La Follettes. So it took quite a while for Dykstra to win over Heil and get Heil's support for the university. Really didn't come until Heil's second term, when the war was looming, and Dykstra's role in national war preparation activities, I think, convinced the governor that Dykstra was not as bad as he had thought originally when he came in. But I think that probably summarizes the two administrations. One thing that is worthy of note, I think, is that Dykstra encouraged during the war university to serve a great many military training programs on campus. And having started out with that objective, he grew increasingly concerned that the military services, primarily the Navy through its radio training school here, was simply interested in the university because it served as a military hotel, provided room and board for the trainees, but no educational services. So he took one of the leading role nationally in developing the college level wartime training programs, the Army Specialized Training Program, or ASTP, and the Navy V-12 program. And for a time, really less than a year in the case of the ASTP program, the university had a significant influx of these college level training programs. But I think in a sense Dykstra was disappointed that the Army and Navy did not make greater use of the University of Wisconsin and colleges and universities nationally in taking a long view of the educational needs of the country during the war years and simply using the campuses for what amounted to military vocational training.
Let's turn for a while to the faculty now. One of the issues that Purdy and Carstensen addressed when they were sitting in the same chair as you're sitting in was the issue of academic freedom in the faculty. John, I guess you're going to address that.
Right. Curdy and Carstensen, I imagine, discussed the sifting and winnowing resolution of the Board of Regents, so we won't need to talk about that here. But it remained a commitment of the university through the interwar years. President Frank,
Start over.
Yeah. President Frank was an eloquent defender of academic freedom over his years at Wisconsin. He was also an advocate for human rights, as that was understood at the time. In the 1920s, for example, political scientist at the Extension Division, Fred H. McGregor, published a pamphlet on taxation, which Governor and then soon to be U.S. Senator John J. Blaine found offensive, and Blaine called for McGregor's firing. To Frank's mind, here was a clear case of academic freedom in jeopardy, and Frank issued this statement: "Any member of a faculty of the University of Wisconsin is and must remain as free to agree with or dissent from any political or economic policy of the state of Wisconsin as he is free to agree with or dissent from any religious rite in Liberia. And as long as I am president of the University of Wisconsin, this complete freedom of thought and expression will be accorded with utter impartiality alike to teachers who entertain conservative opinions and to teachers who entertain radical opinions. The fact that I may think, that an official of the state may think, or that a citizen of the state may think that a teacher's opinions are wrongheaded or even dangerous will not alter this policy. For the whole of human history presents unanswerable proof that only through the open and unhampered clash of contrary opinions can truth be found. To put the matter bluntly, a teacher's opinions, however widely they may differ from the prevailing policies and beliefs at the moment, cannot, with my assent, be made subject of university discipline."
I might interject and say that he was equally strong in his defense of the right of student publications to have complete freedom of the press. And the student publications, notably the Daily Cardinal, but occasionally the Octopus, the humor magazine, occasionally offended conservative alumni or the preachers of the state with some of their utterances or cartoons. And Frank was essentially very solid in defending the right of the student publications to have freedom from administrative censorship. When the regents took offense at the Cardinal's rather consistent opposition to the ROTC program, for example, in the early 1930s, and for a time removed the official designation from the paper. It was known as the official paper of the University of Wisconsin, and for a time even contemplated starting a rival newspaper on the state. Frank quietly resisted that and eventually persuaded the regents to rescind their action. He also warned the alumni that they had to expect that they would confront him if they continued their demand for a change of leadership on the Cardinal. So his record, I think, is better than most university presidents of the period in defending student free speech and free press rights. About the only qualification he put on any of this were what you might call matters of taste, where he found the student's interest in sex or prurient matters and publications likely to get the university in trouble with its constituency. So he did caution the editors of the Cardinal that they would make his life very difficult if they did not exercise some self-control in this area. But I think if you measure him against most presidents of the period, he comes out very well, both in support of faculty rights of free expression and student rights.
There also were problems with academic freedom or challenges to academic freedom during the 1930s and President Dykstra's administration. In 1939, Governor Heil proposed what the newspapers called a red purge after the University of Michigan president Alexander Ruthven expelled several radical students from his institution, at least partially for having attended earlier a National Communist Front organization meeting in Madison.
Ruthven's policy stated, attendance at the University of Michigan is a privilege, not a right. In order to safeguard its ideals of scholarship, character, and personality, the university reserves the right, and the student concedes to the university the right, to require withdrawal of any student at any time for any reason deemed sufficient to it. Now, this was an approach to freedom of speech or speech at the University of Wisconsin that was simply unheard of. But unfortunately, Governor Heil, who didn't have a higher education background, was unaware of this. And so when the reporters informed him of President Ruthven's activities in Michigan, Heil asked the Board of Regents what they were going to do about communistic teaching at the university, and recommended that the Regents throw out students with, as he called it, obnoxious minds. But the Regents, to their credit, and also incidentally a Board of Regents appointed by Governor Heil, refused. They pointed out that the question of political and religious tests for admission to the university was covered in section 36.06 of the statutes, which read, no sectarian or partisan tests shall ever be allowed or exercised in the university or in the administration of, No sectarian or partisan tests shall ever be allowed or exercised in the university or in the admission of students thereto or for any purpose whatever. The Regents are bound by this statute. The Regents concluded their statement by reaffirming the 1894 sifting and winnowing resolution, and Heil, to his credit, soon acquiesced in the face of this solidarity of Regent of the Regents.
I think we need to give President Dykstra some credit for marshaling the Board of Regents behind this position, because initially one or two of the Regents had started out by supporting the governor's position, and I think without some leadership by the president, there might have been a divided board on this question.
Another side of the faculty life on campus had to do with what we call the community of scholars, and also the question of faculty participation and the governance of the university. There's several aspects to this that really began with the administration of Van Hise from 1903 to 1918, but got rounded out in our interwar year period. Van Hise was responsible for the founding of the University Club, which served as a focal point for the faculty community. He also had established a campus planning map whereby new buildings would be arranged in such a way that university scholars would be encouraged to meet and work together and possibly even collaborate in their work and develop more beneficial kinds of findings. He also encouraged the faculty to work in terms of committees to try to figure out what to do about certain university problems or challenges. It was at this period, for example, that the University Committee was established, the most significant university faculty committee that we have operating right now. President Frank encouraged the development of further development of the university community, primarily due to what he called his impresario role as president, in which he was more the orchestra leader rather than actually the player of any instrument. And so this left, for instance, the university deans with many more prerogatives than they'd ever enjoyed under any other university president, and this translated into more freedom for the faculty also to determine what they should do and how they should go about it. Under President Dykstra, his support of the university community was more explicit, and we think that had much to do with his tutoring in the job from L&S Dean George C. Sellery, who had served as the acting president of the university between Frank's firing
and Dykstra's hiring. So when we take together Dykstra's explicit encouragement of the faculty and Glenn Frank's tacit encouragement of them, we ended up with the kind of faculty role in university governance that we now all take more or less for granted, but which before 1925 wasn't anywhere near as effective as we may have thought.
But one aspect of that that I think deserves stress here, the reason the faculty developed a much more impressive role in institutional governance in these years was essentially because it avoided confrontational approaches to either the administration or the regents. There was only one significant confrontation between the faculty and the regents, and that was in the mid-30s when the regents took a more direct role in the intercollegiate athletic program and explicitly overruled the Big Ten Conference dispatched two representatives, two faculty members, to determine whether Wisconsin was in compliance with the requirements of the Big Ten, which held that faculty there had to be faculty control of intercollegiate athletics. Otherwise, the conference rules were that the university would be not in compliance and risked being suspended or expelled from the conference. This was a crisis for the regents because if the faculty here were to tell the Big Ten that there was no faculty control of intercollegiate athletics at Wisconsin, we might be dropped from the conference. So a face-saving compromise was worked out whereby the regents agreed to accept the dominance of the faculty role, and the crisis abated after that. But that's the only instance of direct faculty confrontation. Otherwise, the faculty role, orchestrated mostly by the university committee, was one of great responsibility. And for example, I think this showed most clearly at the time of the so-called salary waivers or salary cuts that took place in 1932 and 1933. And in the second round of faculty salary cuts, the university committee worked out the mechanism for this and the scale and established a really very intelligent approach to the problem with a sliding scale, really rather analogous to the income tax, so that the higher one's salary, the higher the level of the cut. And in return, received from the administration and the regents the assurance that the university would honor all faculty contracts, all tenure, that there would be no threat to layoffs, no threat of layoffs that would violate the tenure or contract provisions of the structure, and that there would be enough flexibility achieved through the salary cuts so that there could be a modest level of promotions and salary increases in this period, and faculty morale would not be totally destroyed in the process. It was a very intelligent approach to the problems of the Depression that I think was quite in contrast to some of the other universities of the country that actually dropped, laid off a significant part of their faculty. At Wisconsin, the younger faculty were retained. We were able to build a base for the future. And one of the things we found most striking was that in every year of the Depression, the university was able to make some faculty appointments at the senior level as well as at the junior level, so that they did achieve enough budgetary flexibility through this process of salary cuts that allowed them to maintain the faculty strength of the university. Really quite remarkable. And I think it's a lesson that we ought not to overlook today, when the temptation at the other end of State Street is always to impose freezes, hiring freezes or other things that constrain the ability of the university to do what it did very well during the Depression years.
The next area that we're going to address is the area of student life during the period 1925 to 1945. Dave, we were talking at lunch the other day, and you were stressing the sense of community that developed within the student area. Do you want to address the issue of student life in these?
Yeah, I think one of the striking things that we've discovered in dealing with both the faculty and the students of the University of Wisconsin in the interwar years is the extent to which there existed real communities of interest. There was here, I think, a real academic community with these constituent parts, the faculty part and the student part. They interacted some, much more closely perhaps than later when the university achieved a much greater size. But in both instances, we're dealing with a much smaller and more homogeneous institution where the faculty really knew each other quite well. The university club served as its focal point for a kind of a campus social life, just as the Memorial Union served that same function after it opened in 1928 for the student community. The student population ranged from about 8,000 at the beginning of our period up to a high of a little over 11,000 in 1939-40, before World War II intruded. There had been a decline in the early years of the Depression, but it resumed growth by the middle 30s up until the peak in 1939-40-41. And then with the advent of the United States entry into the war, there was a marked and sudden fall off of the male population, and the regular student body declined to about 5,900 at the depth of the peak of the war experience. And for the first time, women outnumbered men in the regular student body. Prior to that, they had constituted somewhere between a third to 40% of the undergraduate student body, but never as much as half. Whereas during the war, they in 1943 and again in 1944, women constituted about two-thirds of the regular student body. Now, there were a number of military training programs operating on the campus, as we mentioned, and so there were more men around than appeared on the basis of the regular student body, but it really marked a considerable shift in the normal student life to have women outnumbering the men and really controlling the extracurricular student life. They ran the Cardinal, they ran the Badger, they ran the most of the extracurricular activities of the campus in the war years. So that's a change, but I think the degree to which we're dealing with a smaller, more homogeneous student body meant that there was a real sense of community on the part of the students in these years. And it showed up in a number of ways. For example, in 1931, when the university came under attack by John Chappell, an ambitious Republican politician from Ashland, who thought he could parlay attacks on the university into a political career in the state, and attacked the student body as being radicalized by this radical university, leading immoral lives down in this Sodom and Gomorrah of Madison, and achieved a good deal of notoriety in the state in this regard. The students were incensed at his attacks, just as they later became incensed at some of the attacks of Joseph R. McCarthy in 1950 and 51. And they even went so far as to organize what today would be called truth squads to follow Chappell around the state and correct his impressions of the student body and of the campus. It worked so well that it got institutionalized thereafter until World War II, under the name of the Committee on Public Relations, or Public Relations Committee, got a little bit of university support to help pay the cost of students who would go around the state and speak to high school audiences about the benefits of coming to Madison for their education. And the students really made a very good impression on the public of the state and did a good job in promoting the university and protecting its reputation in this period. That's one example of the kind of sense of community that the students had. It was their university too, and they wanted to protect it and defend it. It showed up in a number of other respects. I'll only mention one that I find exceedingly interesting. In 1940, the student leadership, the student government at the time was called the student board, and the head of the student board thought it would be a good idea if the student body had a work day in the spring to improve the campus in some way, to beautify it. For their first work day, they picked the lake path and decided that it should be widened and be resurfaced. And the students organized, with the help of the Campus Buildings and Grounds Program and acquiring from local WPA project activities, a whole bunch of wheelbarrows and even a steamroller and a grader, and used the campus cinder pile to resurface the whole lake road. They developed a kind of contest between the dorms, the lakeshore dorms, and the Greek houses on Langdon Street, and started the day out by having a band meet at each end of the cycle, at the beginning of Langdon Street and at the Lakeshore Dorms, and marched the students down to the from both directions down to the Memorial Union, where President Dykstra threw the first shovelful of cinders and started the day out. The Fauerbach Brewery contributed some free beer so that at the end of the day, when they had run out of cinders and had done a good job of surfacing most of the lake path, they had a street dance down in front of the Memorial Union with free beer furnished by the Fauerbach Brewery. It went over so well that they continued it every year that thereafter until the end of the war. And in one year, they cleaned up Picnic Point, which had been purchased by the Regents in 1942 and became then university property. 2 years, they planted trees in the Arboretum. And one year, they worked on the playing fields just south of the Agriculture Dean's house, which later became President Fred's house, to develop a playing field for women students. The women did not have as much in the way of recreational facilities as the men did. But in each instance, they would work for the whole day and then have a party afterwards. And I think it's a good illustration of the kind of campus spirit that the students had in this period that I think became lacking to a considerable extent when the university suddenly doubled in size after the war.
John, you were going to talk about the bohemian aspect of student life. Is that what I'm reading upside down here? Or?
No, Barry.
No, I'm not. What's next in your outline?
We were going to talk about the outreach. Did we want to say more about the community students?
I don't think so. Is there anything that I've omitted on the students?
I think it's a nice.
Okay.
I'm satisfied with it. Okay, we're
going to look
outreach.
At a little bit of outreach.
Yeah, let's do some outreach.
Okay.
Reach out.
The Wisconsin idea was a term coined during the Van Hise administration, and part of it referred to the idea that the university not only would be a fine academic institution, but also would serve a practical purpose in the state by helping to improve the life of the people in the state. The three institutions during our period really helped bring again this function of the university to full fruition. The first was the College of Agriculture's Cooperative Extension Service, which was established in the years before World War I. That was a way whereby the College of Agriculture had representatives both within all of its departments and then out in each county of the state. Throughout our period, these agents were both agricultural agents that could help, who could help farmers with their crops, with their marketing, but there were also female home economics agents who could help along family lines and domestic with domestic problems. The College of Agriculture during our period made a rather major shift in its emphasis, particularly with the coming of the Great Depression, placing a much greater emphasis on social studies questions and on agricultural economics matters, as opposed to the older emphasis on producing the maximum number and quantity of crops and so on. Dean of the College of Agriculture, Chris Christensen, pushed this for everything he was worth. He was an agricultural economist who also was an expert on the Danish folk school of, how shall I put it? Danish what?
Just the Danish folk high school.
Dean Christensen revitalized the farm short course, which would have been established all the way back in the 1880s, placing a greater emphasis on cultural and social concerns. He, along with President Frank, hired the college's first artist in residence, John Stuart Curry, and during the war, World War II, this emphasis of the social was connected again with the production emphasis and helped the farmers of Wisconsin to boost the food supply sufficiently to really help the armed forces carry on their business in the war. The University Extension Service, or General Extension as many people knew it, had also started during the Van Hise era. President Frank hired 26-year-old Chester D. Snell from the University of North Carolina in 1926 to move the Extension Service ahead. Originally, it had been a semi-autonomous arm of the university. It had separate funding and was closely aligned with the progressives of the state. But Frank was aware of the Cooperative Extension Service and how it brought the entire College of Agriculture to the rural part of the state, and Frank wanted to do the same thing with General Extension, and that's what he thought Chester Snell could do. As it turned out, especially during the Depression, Snell was a rather dictatorial leader, and he lost the faith of his troops, and there was insurrection. It was a troubling time for Frank because he didn't take firm control of the situation, and the Board of Regents had to step in and fire Snell. But as all the trouble went along, the General Extension Service also carried on its work. It brought courses to people throughout the state, both through the mail and via circuit riders. And later in the Depression, especially under Snell's successor, Frank Holt, a tentative system of freshman and sophomore level schools was established throughout the state. It evaporated during the war, but came back later in Wisconsin as the UW Center system. Also in University Extension in Milwaukee during our period, the center there really took on a life of its own. It got its own building in the 1920s. And later in the 1920s, thanks to the encouragement of Glenn Frank and Alexander Micklejohn, they established a cutting-edge adult education program at the center. But the biggest advance in university outreach during our period was the development of WHA radio. It was a rough period for all of radio during the 1920s, a time when the whole notion of broadcasting as opposed to communication between point A and point B developed, thanks partially to the work of Earl Terry at the University of Wisconsin. But it was a time when there was a limited number of channels for broadcasting and a growing number of stations that wished to broadcast. And the commercial stations and then the commercial networks eventually pushed and pushed the educational stations out of the way. Wisconsin was able to hold on, however, during the 1920s, thanks partially to a sympathetic Glenn Frank. And by the early 1930s, the university station WHA and its sister station WLBL in Stevens Point had really become well established in the state, and depending on weather conditions, was able to blanket the state with programming that now included farmer programming, homemaker programming, public service programming, and then educational programming, both at the university level and at the elementary and high school level. And it was as the 1930s developed, especially toward the end of the 30s, that it really became true, as a pamphlet of the time proclaimed, that the University of Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, that the boundaries of the campus are the boundaries of the state. Throw John in the lake.
Well, I might say a word about the problems we run into in researching and writing Volume 3 compared to the problems faced by Professors Curdy and Carstensen. Their problem was essentially a lack of sources, or the need to find sources for their history, because the university had not kept its records systematically. It did not have a university archives. They had to find records scattered all over the campus in attics and basements and pull them together and try to put together a coherent picture of what had happened in the university during its first 75 years. And one of the results of their research was the decision of the university to establish a university archives that would keep the important historical records of the university for future use by scholars. And our problem, therefore, has been really very different from theirs, where they had a shortage of sources, and sources that cropped up after they thought they had finished a particular section. They, in fact, have a story about how, at the very end, while their book was in page proof, they suddenly discovered a vital collection of Regents' records that they had not known about, and it forced them to go back and make a revision while the book was in page proof, ready to be published. We haven't had that problem. Our problem has been the opposite one, of how we comprehend and put together and organize in a way that makes logical and historical sense an abundance of records. And while there are times when we wish we had records that don't appear to exist, or that we wish people had kept a better recollection of what happened at a particular meeting, or if we wish that we knew the inside story as opposed to the official story of a particular event, we've not lacked for paper in our work. And it's been a question more of how do we organize this abundance of material as opposed to the problem that Curdy and Carstensen faced. So it's as John keeps reminding me, nothing is easy. And that's become a kind of a sub-motto for Volume 3. Now, Volume 4, we indeed do envisage a Volume 4. It will cover the period from the end of World War II to the advent of merger in or shortly after 1971, depending on how we break it. And it will be the more recent history of the university, for which there are pretty good records in the university archives. The archives had not yet developed its philosophy of the importance of managing records by weeding out things that appear to the archivists as less important than other things that are more worthy of retention. And so we don't anticipate perhaps the same degree of problem of recounting the history of the university in this post-war period that will probably confront whoever writes the history of the university after 1971, because then there have been decisions made about what should not be collected, that were not of the sort that that were being done in the period right after the war. So we have, I think, a fortunate situation, namely a rather good collection of archival materials, perhaps less in the way of personal recollections of faculty members, that is a less rich collection of faculty papers for the post-war period as opposed to the pre-war period, but certainly ample material to, I think, tell a pretty good story of the university immediately after World War II. So we're beginning to push ahead with that research, and we anticipate that that volume can be ready about the time of the university's sesquicentennial in 1998-99.
Just looking at volume four from a very general perspective, first of all, I don't know if you mentioned this, so you might hear, what years are you going to be covering? And secondly, do you anticipate any problems in your research at this point? Do you anticipate any real hard spots that you're going to have that are going to be problems?
John?
Well, it's always a problem to write history where the people you're writing about are on the scene, and we're definitely going to encounter that kind of a challenge with Volume 4 more than we did with Volume 3. Although we've actually benefited significantly by several of the people who've either spoken with us or read the manuscript for us. Provided us with lots of information and insights for our work, but with the years that we're going to cover with Volume 4, and it was a period of great turmoil, and there may be problems with interpretation with so many different angles coming, people from so many different angles coming at the story. We don't know yet.
One thing about the more recent period, 1945 to 1971 or thereabouts, is that there are far more oral histories that have been done with members of the university community, faculty, administrators, even students, for that period than there are for the earlier period. And there will be more in the future. Certainly Barry's work has been important in helping us get at certain people through their oral histories that we might not be able to accomplish if we had to rely just on the written record. I think oral histories are very important in giving insights into personalities, frequently in recollecting events. They're less accurate, I think, in relying on people's memories long after the fact for specific dates and the order in which things happened. But you can work around that by relating the oral history comments with the written record that exists. And we find them very useful in getting at personalities or people's recollection of personalities in a way that the bare official records don't certainly relate. So that's an important source, and I'm glad the university's had an oral history program going for the last 20 years, because it is it's rich in a lot of the material that one needs to do an interesting story of the university's development.
Well, I can't think of a more important note to end this interview on than to talk about the oral history, plug for the Oral History Project. Ralph, do you have anything up there?
No, that's great.
Do you guys have anything?
Do you want to say anything about what a positive spirit we found for the 20s and 30s?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I might say that there's a considerable interest on the part of the members of this remarkable university community. Alumni, faculty, students, perhaps less so for the present student body because they're unaware of our existence, but former students, faculty members, administrators are very interested in the fact that we're trying to tell the story of the university in the period in which they knew it. And I anticipate that, well, I hope we won't disappoint them in what we've accomplished in Volume 3, but I'm sure there's going to be a lively interest on the part of people who lived through that period to recount their or relive their experience by seeing what we say about it. And I think that's very healthy, because the university needs to remind itself every now and then of what kind of institution it is, how it got to be where it is today, and really what a remarkable place this is.
One other question, I'm going to direct this to John. When I was listening to Curdy and Carson this morning, they were talking about how initially they had two research assistants, and then they got four, and then they ended up having six. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the staff that you had, including Karen and Gene, and any help that you encountered along the
way. Well, for years it was Barry Tyker and me working. First it was Barry Tyker and me, and then two typewriters, and then an early IBM PC computer showed up, which stood alone silently in a third room for a year, I guess. And once one day we finally started to fool with the thing, and before long we discovered that we didn't have to use our typewriters anymore. And we didn't really need any help because we could just feed those machines with all the information that came along, and then reorganize it according to our needs at the time. We've had some helpers in the project. A crucial helper would be Professor Cronin's wife, Jean Cronin, who voluntarily has gone through the Daily Cardinal and the Capital Times from 1925 through 1945, noting articles and content of articles for us, which were absolutely crucial in our developing the storylines and also getting different slants on issues that came along. We've also had some research assistants, so one at a time. Karen Kaltar is our current assistant. And in fact, while we're doing this, she's at the archives feeding more information into another computer. But compared to Curdy and Carsonson, we've really been able to keep on top of the information ourselves, which I think is beneficial, because it's all run past us, ourselves. And we're really not dependent on what other people did as much, and we're not even dependent on their handwriting and what may or may not have been what they intended to write down. It's all down in print on the screen of our computers. And we can put more information into our database, and we can get more information out in a usable fashion now than it was even dreamed of in the years that Curdy and Carstensen did their work.
I think we might actually have Merle talking about, I asked him what was the greatest innovation during his years as a historian. He said the Xerox machine. And we're definitely beyond that now. One of the fascinating things, and you may or may not want to address this, is the fact that you are setting the type for your own book on your computers in your offices. Do either of you want to talk about
that? Well, we don't know for sure that that's going to happen, but we think it's going to happen. Well, this is another aspect of the computer age in which we live. We think it's going to be possible for us to produce the camera-ready copy for the publication of Volume 3 on our own office computers, and to scan in through using our office flatbed scanner line drawings to enliven the text. Cartoons from The Badger or from the Octopus Humor magazine that will make this, I think, a university history unlike any other that's ever been published. It will be a scholarly history, but we hope it will be more readable than most.
Any idea of how many megabytes of research you have stored on your computer for Volume 3?
Well, just he mentioned Gene Cronin's reading through the 20 years of the Cardinal and the Capital Times. She produced about 8 megabytes of references to the computer, and these were simply one or two sentence summaries, or in some cases simply the title of an article or an editorial that would give us a clue as to its contents, and then we could decide if we later wanted to go read the thing in the original or take a longer run of it. But occasionally she would write a longer amount than that, but This means that she was entering on what would be a single page of typewriter-sized paper, maybe 25 or 30 entries, and altogether that added up to a huge number of pages in the computer, but in effect amounted to an index, a university index of the Cardinal and the Capital Times for these years, a really valuable resource, and one that we have found extremely useful as we've been writing, because we can then decide whether we want to go look at the microfilm of the Cardinal if we've got this entry that we can tell what its content is.
Anybody reading Volume 3 will just have to look at the footnotes and see how many references there are to the Cardinal and to the State Journal to understand how valuable this research has been.
Well, they'll find a great many.
Okay, I think that's all wrapped.